This is Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlohm. Coming up on the show, we're going to explore how space missions actually work with science writer and physics educator Tricia Murrow. In her new book, It's Just Rocket Science, Murrow uses actual NASA space missions from Voyager to the space shuttle launches and the James Webb Space Telescope to break down the basic science behind the how and why of spaceflight. When astronauts are in orbit, why do they feel weightless even though they are in a fairly strong gravitational field? How do you use the gravity of a planet to slingshot a space probe onto another? From gravity to electromagnetic wave phenomena, Tricia Murrow guides us to a basic understanding of how it works and why we are able to do amazing things in space. Time for liftoff right after this.
Thank you.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. When I was teaching physics, one of my favorite things would be when a student had the proverbial aha moment, when understanding something fundamental truly turned on the light bulb of the mind. And often, because I was so interested in it, it would revolve around how rockets are launched and why astronauts are weightless in space, even though they're in a gravity field that's nearly as strong as if they were on the surface of the Earth. Once you get that they're weightless not because they're in space, but because they're in a perpetual state of free fall, you understand a lot of things, like why you feel momentarily weightless on the drop of a roller coaster ride. Hopefully in this show, you'll have one or two of those aha moments yourself. Our guest is Tricia Murrow. Tricia has taught high school physics, worked as a member of the Hubble Space Telescope team, and now she's written a wonderful new book to help us all understand the basic physics behind amazing NASA missions. Titled It's Just Rocket Science, Exploring Physics Through Spaceflight Missions, Tricia Murrow's book is both fun to read, clear, and enlightening, and she joins us now to talk about it. Tricia Murrow, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we have a lot in common, and we'll get to that, but first of all, I'd like to know more about you. You obviously have a deep love for science in general, spaceflight specifically, and physics. Tell us about some of the formative experiences when you were growing up that really, you know, sparked your curiosity and led you on your path that led ultimately to teaching about physics in this book.
I grew up in Silicon Valley in the 1980s, where my dad worked at Intel for many years. And so he helped me with a few key science fair experiments when I was growing up. But I was a pretty dismal student. For most of elementary school, I kept getting notes from my teachers that, you know, Tricia wasn't really paying attention and was careless in her work. And it wasn't until the Challenger explosion in 1986 that I started to realize, oh, science makes a big difference and it's really important to learn it well. And something just got sparked in me as I watched the investigation and they figured out what went wrong and how to prevent it in the future.
Richard Feynman's famous demonstration.
Exactly. Yes. The O-rings in the ice cold glass of water. You got it.
And you actually did a science project, science fair project about that, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
Tell us about that with your dad.
Yeah, we went to the hardware store and I mean, I grew up going to Radio Shack all the time with him, but, we got a bunch of metal O-rings of different types of metal, and we rented a vernier caliper to measure them very precisely. And we measured them at room temperature, and then we turned up the oven to like, you know, 250 degrees or so. And then we cranked it all the way up to, I don't know, 500 degrees, however high it would go. And we measured it at each temperature to see how the size of the O-ring changed. And I remember at the time that I hadn't quite learned algebra yet, so I didn't really understand proportions, but this was a really hands-on way to figure that out and see that different metals changed by different amounts. And those key amounts told us about the metal.
And then for our listeners who may not be completely aware of what happened to Challenger, and that famous demonstration that Richard Feynman did before Congress, before that investigation panel, tell us what happened to Challenger.
Yeah, so Challenger launched in January, and the night before the launch was extremely cold. It was in the 20 degrees level in Florida.
Ice was hanging off of Challenger.
Exactly. Ice was on the launch pad. And the white solid rocket boosters that are on each side of the space shuttle are made in segments. And each segment was joined with the help of some rubber O-rings. And those O-rings were not metal like the ones I used. They were rubber. But what Feynman demonstrated is that in extremely cold temperatures, those O-rings lost their ability to seal the joint. And so in this tragic occasion, one of the O-rings failed. Hot gases from the rocket leaked through and actually, I guess, melted the joint. And the rocket came loose, that caused the explosion. lots of details in there, but it was essentially the failure of the O-rings.
They put a blowtorch to that hydrogen tank and just it exploded. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, you, interestingly enough, you went to work on the Hubble Space Telescope. Tell us about that experience, because that's pretty darn cool.
It was pretty amazing. Yeah, it was. I went to school at Johns Hopkins, and right across the street is the Space Telescope Science Institute, which is the astronomy home for Hubble Space Telescope, now also for the James Webb Space Telescope, and soon for the Roman Space Telescope, the Nancy Grace Roman. And I applied to a summer internship, and the internship was essentially doing data processing for, we called it the phone book for the Hubble Space Telescope. So it was just this massive, massive database of over 2 million very well-known, very plain stars that Hubble used to lock onto its position while it was doing scientific observations. And so Hubble needed to have these, they're called guide stars. Hubble needed to have these guide stars in all portions of the sky, all times of the year. And so my job was to take the ground-based observations of these guide stars and run them through a processing pipeline and get them into the proper formats and get the data that they needed. But what started as a summer internship ended up being almost 5 years of work while I finished school and while I started teaching.
Those kind of experiences where you get to do an internship can be so powerful for a young person who may not know what they want to do, but then all of a sudden they get exposed to something and say, oh, I love this. This is what I'd like to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, my first internship was actually at MIT Haystack Observatory, which was a radio observatory out in Western Massachusetts. And it just happened to be the summer of the Shoemaker-Levy 9 comet collision with Jupiter.
Yeah, that was an amazing event. And the Hubble Space Telescope famously also observed that.
Yes. Yes, it did.
All right. You also, we have something in common. I taught high school physics for 30 years.
Oh, wonderful. Yes.
Yes. And it can be quite challenging at times and often very rewarding. Tell us about that and how, you know, what drew you to teaching physics?
Well, I was never a traditional learner myself. I mean, I talked about elementary school, but even once I really got fired up and wanted to learn more, I still struggled. I had a hard time and I worked really, really hard. I always sought out, you know, extra resources, and I knew the librarians at my school very, very well. They were always so helpful. And in college, I started volunteering with something called the Hopkins Tutorial Project, which is a volunteer program where Hopkins undergrads were matched with inner city elementary school kids. And that just opened my eyes to the educational inequities of our public school system. And I decided I want to do something to help. And so I stayed on at Hopkins for an extra year and got a master's in science teaching and started teaching high school physics right out of that program. I loved it. It was wonderful.
Yeah, teaching physics was, I taught physics and earth science and chemistry over the years. But physics was always my absolute favorite course to teach.
Yeah, it's hard to beat.
It's just so cool. Which leads us to this wonderful book. It's like, you know, when I saw this book and I read the title and I just glanced through it, I went, oh, where was this a few years ago when I was teaching? Because I sure would have liked to have had this as a resource to share with my students.
Oh, you're going to make me cry.
What a cool book. Because it makes so much of physics accessible and interesting and relatable. Tell us, you know, what was the impetus to writing this? And the wonderful title, it's just being in parentheses. Because, you know, that's such a famous saying. It's, well, it's not rocket science. You just got to put, you know, this with that. But it's a great book. It's so fun to read and very accessible, I think, for just about anybody.
Oh, my gosh. That just warms my heart to hear. I'm so glad. It started when I went back to school for a second master's in science writing, actually, just after COVID. And I wanted to help put, you know, tricky science concepts into stories and explanations that would make sense to people. And I just remembered how much I loved learning about space and in the process learning about physics. And, you know, like I say in the book, I was always told, well, if you want to learn about space, you have to learn a bunch of physics and math first. And with this book, I just wanted to flip the order of operations on that and say, well, yeah, let's learn about space and let's learn about physics and a tiny little bit of math.
Well, I love it because with kids, especially young kids, you know, what are they most interested in science? Dinosaurs and outer space. You know, those are the gateway drugs to science.
Yep.
And, you know, if you can take that spark of interest in space and then, you know, use that as your vehicle to teach the math and the physics.
Absolutely.
You know, it's such a great idea. I applaud you for doing that.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you also tell the story about a student you had, you know, like 40 years ago who said, you know, she wanted more stories in your physics. And that was, I thought that was kind of a lovely little story.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't even know who she was because when she dropped my class on the second day of school. And, you know, that happens for lots of reasons. Schedules change and, you know, kids change their minds, all that stuff. So I have no idea who she was. But as I was signing her drop ad form, she said, yeah, I was just kind of hoping it would be like story physics. And at the time, it just didn't make any sense to me. You know, I had my curriculum that I needed to teach. Physics was forces and equations and numbers and graphs. And I just didn't even understand what she meant by story physics. But I've remembered that tiny little interaction all these years. And when I set out to write this book, I was like, I need to make this story physics, space story physics. And that just became my theme throughout it all.
Yeah, and it's a great way to do it. What I like about this is for the general public is each chapter it's pretty easily digestible. They're not super long. You go into just enough detail to give you a basic understanding, and there's a little bit of math along the way if you want to, you know, delve into that. It's not that difficult math, but, you know, there are some people that get very freaked out when they, you know, just hear the word math.
Mm-hmm.
You make it understandable, and I love that. When you say it's just rocket science, it's a great title because really rocket science, it's not that difficult to understand. Rocket engineering, on the other hand, that's difficult.
Yes. Yes. And it gets like rocket science gets very, very complicated. But the basic principles are the basic principles of physics. And so in order to understand it, all you need are the basic principles. In order to make it happen, my goodness, you need loads of graduate degrees and lots of math.
Yeah, the engineering's where it gets really tough.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But making the rocket and getting it to go where you want, when you want, and do the things you want it to do. That's all real hard.
It sure is.
And so my question for you is, how did you go about picking the missions? Because what you do is you take, you know, NASA missions, for example, you use missions like the rovers on Mars and the cool helicopter, the Dragonfly. You use all of these different missions. How did you go about picking them and how did you do that?
Some of the missions I knew right away that I wanted to do. Ingenuity, the helicopter on Mars, I knew I wanted to do something with that. But I had never heard of Dragonfly when I started. That was something that I discovered as I did more research.
Tell our listeners what Dragonfly is.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Dragonfly is a future helicopter. It's a quadcopter, or actually an octocopter, meaning it has 8 rotors, that will go to Saturn's moon Titan, and it launches in 2028. So it's well past the design phase. It's blazing through its testing phase, and it's being built right now. But like I said, I hadn't heard of it when I started the book. It was something that I discovered along the way quite joyfully. And I actually got a chance to see the spacecraft last week out at the Applied Physics Lab, which was just thrilling. Other missions like the DART spacecraft, I just happened to be on campus at Johns Hopkins for a totally different reason. I guess it was about 10 days before the collision happened. DART was a mission where we sent a very small spacecraft to purposefully impact an asteroid, a binary asteroid, in an attempt to change its orbit. And so, like I said, about 10 days before the impact, I was on Hopkins campus when there was a public presentation by one of the chief scientists, Elena Adams. And so I was like, oh, I'd love to listen to that. Yeah. And as I listened, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. How are they doing this? And so afterwards, I got in touch with the media relations people at APL and asked if I could interview Elena Adams for some more follow-up questions. And in every single instance, the media relations folks and the scientists themselves were so generous with their time, with their expertise. They're, as you said earlier, they're just so excited to be able to communicate what they do and what they love to do.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Tricia Murrow, the author of the new book, It's Just Rocket Science, Exploring Physics Through Spaceflight Missions. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our interview with Tricia Murrow, author of the new book, It's Just Rocket Science, Exploring Physics Through Spaceflight Missions. We had the recent Artemis II mission, which was fabulous, and I'm sure you
sure
followed
did.
It closely from beginning to end, as I did. And
oh, goodness,
maybe
yes.
Maybe even had tears in your eyes at the end like I did. And
you guessed it.
I was
it.
Just so proud that we, you know, finally, after all these years, left Earth, low Earth orbit, and, you know, actually went somewhere with astronauts. It was so cool. So let's use that as some, because I got some questions from a friend that I thought would be great for you to answer. People have such a limited understanding of what's going on. So let's just start out with some really simple stuff. Let's just start out with the International Space Station. You know, the astronauts communicated with them. They had a little conference between the two spacecraft, which is cool. A lot of people don't understand that just because you are in the space station, that the fact that they see that you're in microgravity or weightless, that has nothing to do with your position. That, mm-hmm. you know, because literally, if you were just to stop them there and you could magically hold on to them and keep them there at, you know, 300 miles above me, there would be gravity. It would be slightly less, but there would be gravity and you would fall instantly. So there's gravity there. Let's explain to people, let's have you explain to people, why is it that they are weightless?
All righty. So I'll share a story that I tell in the book, which is that when I was a little kid, we had an apricot tree growing in our front yard. And for whatever reason, I loved jumping out of that apricot tree. And I would try jumping farther and farther and farther away. And it turns out that Isaac Newton had the same kind of thought experiment where he imagined what would happen if you could blast a cannonball out of a cannon with more and more power, more and more speed. And this became a very famous thought experiment because what he imagined was blasting that cannon so fast that by the time it fell to Earth's surface had already curved away. It traveled so far that it's essentially outrunning gravity. And that's essentially what an orbit is. Your energy of motion is matching the curvature of the Earth, the gravitational potential energy that you're getting. And so when you're in orbit, you're in a state of constantly falling, but you're not falling to Earth, you're falling around the Earth. So your path is matching Earth's curvature. And that's why you're feeling weightlessness. You're exactly right. When you're up at that orbital altitude, gravity is still like 90% as strong as it is here on the surface. It's a very small difference. The key is all in that free fall.
Yeah. It's like if you were to imagine yourself, if you were to put yourself in a big box and drop it out of a high altitude aircraft.
Yeah.
You would be in free fall inside that box. You would feel weightless just like an astronaut.
Yep.
You know, and hopefully you'd have a parachute that would open to keep
hopefully
you from
so, yes.
splatting into the Earth. But it's the same concept.
Yes.
Yeah. And then and one of the questions I got asked that I got a kick out of, because it's like, this is a smart guy. He just, you know, doesn't quite understand how rocket engineering work. He asked me, it's like, well, when they're coming back, you know, through the atmosphere, why don't they just have more fuel and fire rockets so they'll slow them down so that, you know, don't, because he was, you know, understood that going so fast through the atmosphere causes all this heat, it's dangerous. Why don't they just, you know, have big rockets and fire them so that they can come back, you know, more safely? And I heard that question, went, I understand that question, but boy, that's somebody who doesn't understand how, the basics of something called the rocket equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So the rocket equation basically says that the more you want to launch into space, the more fuel you need. And fuel is really, really heavy. So the more fuel you have on board, the bigger engine you need. And the bigger engine you have, the more fuel you need. It's this vicious cycle that people often call the tyranny of the rocket equation.
Yes.
And so, yeah, your friend is, it's a really great guess. It's like, why don't they just fire up the, you know, the retro rockets?
Mm-hmm.
Then it would be so much heavier coming back. It would create other problems that would make it harder to launch in the first place.
You would need just an exorbitant amount of fuel. And when you look at a rocket like the Space Launch System or the old space shuttle, you know, when you're looking at that, or from my childhood, the Saturn V, you know, almost all of it, everything you're looking at with that giant rocket sitting out there, is fuel.
It's fuel, yeah.
They're just big giant tanks to hold fuel.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, but like you said, that's the tyranny of the rocket equation.
It sure is.
And that definitely is rocket science.
Yes, and rocket engineering.
Yeah. He also was wondering, and I thought this was kind of an interesting question, like, well, why, when they come back and, you know, land in the ocean, since if they were so hot, you know, thousands of degrees, you know, the temperature of the sun and, you know, all the figures that the media was spouting out about how hot they were getting and how dangerous it was.
Yeah.
Why, when it hits the water, isn't it just a huge explosion of steam?
Ooh, that is a good question.
I thought that was a great question.
My guess is that it is sufficient to cooled, like, it is steaming for sure.
It's hot.
You know, you can see, yeah, but you can see some of the steam,
but
when it's
not that hot, because by the time that they land in the ocean, you know, the whole way the heat shield works is the process of ablation.
Ablation
is
that
you're removing the heat as you go. You're losing little teeny bits of that heat shield, and you're ablating that heat away. You're taking it away from the spacecraft. So when it gets back, yes, it's hot, but it's not that hot.
Right. That's the whole, whether it's the tiles on the space shuttle or the ablative heat shield here, the whole name of the game is to just bleed off the extra heat safely and efficiently.
Yes. And thank goodness it worked.
Thank goodness. Oh my goodness.
And then another one that I've got asked a lot about, which is very cool because it takes me back to the Apollo days and working with my friend Jerry Griffin to explain Apollo 13, for example, was the trajectory that they used, because there was a lot of comparisons with Artemis and Apollo 8, but unlike Apollo 8, which went into orbit around the moon, they did not do that. They went just on a big, long swing around the moon and came back. It was not an orbital mission to the moon. It was an orbital mission around the moon.
Right.
But you do a really nice job of explaining, you know, that there's no free lunch, but you do get some snacks.
You get some tasty snacks.
Tell us about what's called a free return trajectory.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. The free return trajectory is not what was used in Apollo 8. Apollo 8 orbited, I think, 10 times around the moon, but it was used in Apollo 13. And if you've seen the movie, they do a beautiful job showing, you know, depicting much of what happened there. But it quite literally does put Isaac Newton and the laws of gravitation in charge of things, where you align your spacecraft at just the right speed and just the right angle at just the right position and just the right time, and fire one engine burn, again, very precisely, just the right time, just the right thrust, and you're essentially set up in kind of an automatic loop around whatever planetary body you're circling or going around. So in this case, the moon. And so it's extremely efficient. You do have to be very, very precise, obviously, but you're not firing the rockets the whole time you're going around. You're letting gravity do the work of transferring the angular momentum and curving your path just the right way. And of course, as I say in the book, the tricky part is getting all those details right to so many decimal points of precision. And that's where it's, you know, that's where it really is rocket science and rocket engineering.
Yeah, where you used a great example. I forget who it was, but you had a teacher, professor, somebody who would just round off pi to 3.
Yeah.
To get it, just to get yourself an, you know, a back of the envelope concept of what kind of number we're looking at here. Yeah, just use 3. You don't need to use the whole thing. But then you talk about, you know, the actual NASA engineers. Gosh, what's her name?
Poppy Northcutt.
Northcutt, yes. You know, the insanely long version of pi.
It was
out to, oh gosh, I don't remember how many digits.
I think it was 32 digits.
32, yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's...
My goodness.
That's the precision you need.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or actually,
and
accuracy.
Now, you know, it's most of the... That was one of the questions I really wanted to ask all of the rocket scientists is, how many digits of pi do you use? And, you know, most of them said that they use, instead of an actual number, they use the variable. They use just the computer version of it. But Patrick Chai, one of the rocket scientists from, I believe, Langley, said, you know, every time you add digits, you add precision, but you also add complexity. And so just like with the rocket equation, it's a balance between how much you need and how much you're willing to add in that complexity.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't thought about it that quite that way. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to Newton's basic laws. You do a very lovely job. I believe it was with the dragonfly chapter of just explaining, you know, those three laws of motion that everybody's heard about, but conceptually they don't really quite understand them. So, and one of the best ways that I always, you know, was interesting to me to hear students ask me stuff when I was teaching was like, when I explained to them how far away Voyager was, when it crossed into interstellar space, they're getting out there, you know, distance where it's taking their radio signals, light, you know, almost a day to reach us here back on Earth.
They're almost exactly
really
now,
far away. And they said, and they would ask, how do they have enough fuel to do that? And
ooh,
I was like,
yeah.
Oh, okay. We don't understand. So let's start there. Why doesn't Voyager need to fire rockets?
So Voyager had a very lucky coincidence at launch in the positions of the outer planets, in that it was able to launch with, you know, a certain amount of speed and then perform several gravitational slingshots, which is when you pick up some angular momentum from, in this case, a planet to change your direction ever so slightly, but mostly to pick up speed for Voyager. And so when it launched from Earth, it certainly had enough energy, enough speed to get out of Earth orbit and to start going outward, but it would not have had enough kinetic energy, enough energy of motion to escape the solar system just on its own. It would have needed much bigger rockets. But by passing through each of the outer planets, passing around them, it was able to pick up the speed it needed. And now, way, way, way out there, its momentum is just letting it keep on going. It's just coasting out farther and farther and farther. So it doesn't need it doesn't need engines anymore.
Yeah, the first law of motion, you know, basically tells us, it's the law of inertia, that once you are in motion, you will continue in that straight line motion unless some unbalanced outside force is acting upon you. And so there really isn't any outside force acting upon it. It's just going to go in a straight line or whatever path it's on and go into orbit around the Milky Way galaxy for a billion years. It's just quite amazing. Also very cool, you know, to think about Voyager. It was launched the year I graduated from high school, 1977, and took advantage of this, I think it was a once every 176-year alignment. 173-year alignment of the planets to be able to do that. Kind of, you know, little miniature versions of that free return trajectory where you're taking that the gravity of that planet and using it to your advantage. And the fascinating thing to me is, in physics, all these quantities are always conserved. You know.
Yes.
That yes, you gain speed going around Saturn, but Saturn lost a little bit of its orbital
just
motion,
just a tiny bit.
It's,
yeah.
It's so negligible. It's ridiculous, but it's still kind of cool to contemplate that.
It is. And it's so amazing to think, you know, of those proportions, like the proportions that I didn't quite understand in sixth grade doing that science fair experiment with my dad. But it's exactly what you said. The spacecraft gains a huge burst in speed and Saturn loses proportionally a tiny little bit, each according to their masses and, you know, a bunch of angles and stuff, but mostly according to their masses.
You also get into one of the things I hated about physics when I took it, like in high school, was I never got to the stuff I was really interested in.
Oh, me too.
Like relativity, yes. You know, yeah. I want to know about that because that's right. The cool stuff. But it's never seemed to get to it. But you do, and I thought it was wonderful how you explained, you know, general relativity and this really cool thing called gravitational lensing. Mm. So tell us just a little bit about that, because that's really neat.
Oh, how do you know that's my favorite? I think gravitational lenses are just the most amazing thing. Essentially, what's happening with the gravitational lens is that space-time itself is getting warped by something massive. And space-time, you know, we often imagine it as a giant rubber sheet, something that's kind of flexy and, you know, something small like, let's see, something small like a tree isn't going to deflect space-time very much. But a planet sure will, and a galaxy will deflect it even more. But the idea is that anything that has mass will change the shape of space-time just a little bit according to its mass. And so on Earth, you know, if I'm trying to look at a distant tree and a truck comes and parks in my way, well, now my view of the tree is blocked. But especially out in distant space, if I'm looking at something that's extremely far away, like usually we use the example of a quasar, which is just super, super far away, but very, very bright. If there's a galaxy in between us, that galaxy does not block our view of the quasar in the way that the truck blocks the view of the tree. Instead, the galaxy makes light curve. And so light, and it's tricky to explain that, right? Light is still traveling in its own straight line, but space-time itself is curved. And so it looks like light is curving. And as a result, you get these wacky images where, you know, sometimes it'll look like a smear or a circle if it's perfect, or multiple images of exactly the same thing.
The Einstein cross is my favorite, yeah.
Exactly. And now, you know, between Hubble and JWST, we have so many examples of gravitational lenses. But you know, when I was in college, I think it was right around 1993, and I think it was even before the Hubble servicing mission, I remember one of my professors coming in and, you know, slapping an image on the board and saying, you know, what do you think this is? And it was Einstein cross. It was these multiple images, and it, you know, it looks like it's, huh, why are there four images of the same thing? And that was, you know, one of the first really, really clear examples. Wow, it really does work the way we think it works.
Yeah, and fascinatingly, when Einstein first came out with the general theory of relativity, they really didn't have a way to test it until there was a big solar eclipse event.
Exactly.
And Sir Arthur Eddington led an expedition, and they took very detailed photographs of the eclipse. And they had stars in the images that should not be visible because they're basically on the other side of the sun, like blocked by the tree, like what you were saying. And yet there they were. Confirming that space and time was bent around the sun, which is just, that's a mind-blowing.
Exactly. And now we have so many just neat examples of these gravitational lenses. There's so many examples. It just boggles my mind every time.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we'll continue our conversation with author Tricia Murrow as we explore the basic science behind spaceflight. Her new book, published by Johns Hopkins Press, is titled It's Just Rocket Science, Exploring Physics Through Spaceflight Missions. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our interview with Tricia Murrow. Tricia studied physics at Johns Hopkins University, worked at the Space Telescope Science Institute, and taught high school physics. Her new book, It's Just Rocket Science, helps readers understand the basic science behind spaceflight missions. Let's talk about light and radio. Because this is a radio program, essentially. And people get very confused between the term radio and sound.
Yeah.
And they're not the same thing.
They are not.
Radio is actually light. Could you just explain that to us a little bit?
Yeah, correct. So sound waves are very physical. They depend on matter to travel through. And the classic example that I'm sure you've seen at science museums is with a slinky. And for sound waves, the type of wave is when you would be like pushing and pulling on the slinky to make little waves of compression and expansion. And light is completely, utterly different. Light is electromagnetic. Light is based on oscillations of the electric field and the magnetic field. But it also does not depend on matter at all. It can travel through a vacuum, as we know, because we see the sun shining, you know, as the light travels through space. And light, what we call light, is just a tiny little fraction of this huge spectrum called the electromagnetic spectrum, because they're all electromagnetic waves. Now, these EM waves can get extremely complicated, but right there, that little sliver of visible light that we can see is every single color that we know, the rainbow, every single color. And just beyond it, in the less energetic side of the spectrum, we have infrared, we have microwaves, and we have radio waves. So these are mostly going to be different in wavelength or frequency. Radio waves are very, very long wavelengths. They're really low energy. And then you move up the spectrum to microwaves. Infrared is what we mostly perceive as heat. Get back to visible. And then we start going up the opposite end of the spectrum to the more energetic side.
The dangerous light, as I like to call
it. Exactly, the dangerous stuff, right? Here's where you can start to get ionizing radiation, as it's called. The ultraviolet light, which we all know, you know, we wear sunscreen to protect our skin so that we don't get skin cancer. And then into x-rays, right? When you get an x-ray at the doctor, they usually put a nice big lead apron over your torso to protect your vital organs. And then all the way up to gamma rays. But light, what we call light, the visible portion of the spectrum, is just so, so, so tiny. But to bring it back, as you said, your show broadcasts over radio waves, and those are very, very long wavelength. I mentioned earlier, you know, my first internship was at MIT Haystack, which is a radio telescope. And so the great thing for astronomy is that you can do radio astronomy in the middle of the day.
But and one of the misconceptions that people get when they hear like radio astronomy is if they think you're listening for sounds from space.
Right, right.
When really what you're just doing is you're gathering a form of light. It has bigger, longer wavelengths. It's carrying information. So like, you know, when I record this, our voices are converted into information, data.
Yep.
And that data is transmitted at the speed of light through radio waves and travels into your antenna and then into your radio. And then your radio speaker turns that signal back into audible sound.
Correct.
So radio and sound are really different. And, you know, you give a really great example that we all know, the old, you know, count how many times you count after the lightning strike and see how far away it was. So tell it for folks that aren't familiar with that, because that people have kind of lost track of that basic knowledge. Tell us how that works, because that's kind of a neat thing.
I remember very much as a kid, I used to think that the old saying of, you know, count every 5 seconds after the lightning strikes means it's a mile away, means the lightning struck a mile away between the lightning and the thunder. And I used to think that meant, oh, well, that's because light travels 5 times faster than the sound.
Wrong.
Completely wrong. No, that is not at all wrong. Not at all correct. Light travels, you know, so much more than that. And what it really is doing is it's taking the speed of sound through air and just converting it into miles per second, or how many seconds to get to 1 mile.
That's about 750 miles an hour is the speed of sound, basically.
Exactly. Or in meters per second.
Speed of light is so much faster than that.
Exactly.
Just, you know, to give for an example back to Artemis, it's about 1.3 seconds for light to go from the moon or a radio signal from Artemis to the Earth. And that was what was cool, too, is during the mission is you could hear that little bit of delay. Mm-hmm. You know, when they're talking back and forth, that takes, you know, a little while for that signal to get out there and then come back.
Yeah. And I love this example, too, because it's a great place to bring in a little bit of number sense. So you were quoting the 700-ish miles per hour speed of sound. I still remember it as 330 meters per second. And so that, in scientific notation, that would be, you know, 3 times 10 to the 2, 300. And the speed of light is 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second.
That's a lot more.
It's a whole lot more. And to figure out how much more with those exponents, they're so handy. Even though I know people, you know, see them and it looks a little scary and you're like, okay, wait, times 10, what does that mean? But for an example like this, you just subtract the 8 and the two exponents. So that makes 6. So the difference, the factor at which light is faster,
it's a million.
Is 10 to the 6 or 1 million. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's such a great example for number sense with scientific notation and why even though it looks a little bit more complicated, it actually makes things a whole lot easier.
Yeah. It always amazes me. And I was a victim of it as a child too, where I was scared of math and it took me a while to get over it. People sometimes have this horrible dreaded math phobia. Mm-hmm. Or the thing, I'm sure you've heard this as a teacher a lot, is, you know, the kid would be struggling with something and then the parent would tell you, well, I don't understand this because I'm just not a math person.
Yeah.
And my counter to that is, you know, there's no such thing as a math person or not a math person. It's, you know, it's just whether you decide to learn how to do it. But that doesn't take some special talent.
No.
You don't have to have, you know, fast twitch muscles to do math and be able to slam dunk or anything like that.
Exactly. No, it is a skill that can be built with practice and with good instruction and more practice and more practice. Absolutely.
And when you get that little bit of number sense, like you said, and you do learn some of these basic equations from physics, I don't know, but for me, it just opens the world up and makes it more beautiful because you have a depth of understanding.
Agreed.
It's so interesting to me that people are so afraid of it.
Yeah. I wish that I could continue to do more to help change that because way back when I was teaching, I would kind of love it when a student would come in and say, I love physics or I love science, but I'm just not good at math. And I just felt like saying, come on in, you know, we can work on this. We got you. Even that sense of self-doubt, you know, it opens you up to so much growth. And so that the little tiniest spark of interest, it's like, all right, we can work with this. We can do this.
And it's always so cool when you see that person get that aha moment.
Yes.
Like, oh, I get this. Now I get it.
It is the best.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get back to your book. There's a really neat accounting that you tell about. You were there for, I think it was a Hubble, the last servicing mission.
It was.
Of the space shuttle. And I love how you describe, because I've had this experience myself, that, you know, you've watched the IMAX movies and you've got, you know, you got the super surround sound going and, you know, you've heard the rocket roar and, you know what this is going to be like because you've experienced it so many times at space camp. And then when you're there for the real thing, tell us about what that's like.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I really thought that I knew what I was in for, and I was so wrong. There are no words. It was so surreal. And, you know, just like with lightning and thunder, the difference in time delay between seeing the fire from the rocket boosters that, you know, were clearly igniting and lifting the shuttle off the pad, and yet we still hadn't heard it yet. Oh my goodness, it was just remarkable. And it did, you're right. It meant so much more, the fact that it was the last Hubble servicing mission. And, you know, by that time I had moved fully into teaching, so I wasn't working with Hubble anymore, but I still had that deep connection to it and knowing, wow, you're going to go help Hubble last even longer. And here it is, you know, it's 2026 now and Hubble is still growing strong. But yeah, the launch experience.
It's like one of the things that's hard to convey to people is you feel it.
Yes.
As much, you know, it's sound, but it's such concussive sound waves of those engines hitting you. It's just like, oh, it's such a...
Yes, if you're at a parade and the biggest drums go right in front of you, you can feel it in your chest. Yeah. Yeah, it really is just, as you said, it's crackling, it's concussive, it's really quite visceral.
And emotional.
Yeah. I'm amazed that I was able to take those two pictures that I included in the book.
Yeah, very cool. One of the interesting things to me, thinking about the future is, and you mentioned Star Trek a few times in your book, which has also endeared you to me. Science fiction really works best if there's a plausibility to it, that this maybe we don't have this technology yet, but it's on the horizon and you can sense it. I mean, you think back to the original Star Trek when they had communicators.
Right.
And I thought, wow, that's fancy. And now it's like, well, now I've got a phone that's way fancier than that.
Way fancy, yeah.
But let's talk about some exotic forms of propulsion for the future. Maybe not warp drive, but some cool ways to go out and explore deep space. Let's talk about using electromagnetic waves to explore.
You know, we got to give them a pass with things like warp drive, because otherwise there'd be no way to tell a story if we can't get to, you know, the next star system over for hundreds of years.
A little difficult to write a weekly script around that.
Exactly, exactly. But one of the types of propulsion that I learned about was, it's called solar electric propulsion. And essentially what it does is you still collect energy through your solar panels and store it up in a battery, but then you use electric and magnetic fields to strip the electrons off of a gas, a noble gas.
Ionize
in this
them.
Case, exactly, to ionize them. In this case, it's usually xenon. And you expel those plasma ions. And it's so, so, so gentle. Very, very little thrust. So this is not something that you could launch with. The example that one of my scientists gave me is that it's the amount of thrust that would feel like a piece of bread in your hand. And yet, when you use that type of engine over an extremely long time, like when your spacecraft is out cruising, you know, from Earth or past Earth orbit out to its next destination, like Jupiter, it takes a long time. So if you have a tiny amount of thrust over a very long time, it's kind of like compound interest in your bank account.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep growing. Your speed keeps growing. And so it becomes an extremely efficient way to get a lot of bang for a very little buck. And I wish that I had had more space to go into E&M, electricity and magnetism, in the book, because it's a pretty complicated process. We had to gloss over a lot, but that's the gist of it.
Hey, well, I smell a sequel on the horizon for you.
That would be delightful. I'd love to do an E&M one.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we go, you also mentioned at the end, as I'm feeling the same way, a lot of trepidation and sadness about, you know, at the time of this writing, you know, all of these missions going on. And yet, you know, in this last year, we've seen these dramatic, draconian cuts to science across the board, all the sciences.
Yeah. And it's really gone through quite the roller coaster in the last couple of weeks, too. Earlier this spring, Congress voted to restore much of the funding to NASA and to the National Science Foundation. And then during, gosh, it was even during the Artemis II mission, the next year's budget was announced, budget proposal was announced with those same cuts right back again. And the people are so irreplaceable, their expertise. Yeah, the loss of that expertise is just beyond devastating.
It is, and science will survive, you know,
yep.
Because
science will go on without
us. There are other countries doing science just fine.
Yes,
but
yes.
It's tragic to see America, who's always been a leader in science and technology, just going utterly backwards.
Yeah.
Well, Tricia Moreau, it's been a joy to talk to you, and I just love this book. It's just Rocket Science, Exploring Physics Through Spaceflight Missions. It's awesome. It's very clearly written, very accessible to anyone. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was delightful.
Thanks again to our guest, Tricia Moreau. Her new book, It's Just Rocket Science, Exploring Physics Through Spaceflight Missions, is available at most major booksellers or order it from your favorite local bookstore. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises, and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.